and welcome to the Clever Tax Podcast, Creating Useful People. I'm Jodie Cook, and today I'm joined by Katrina Owen. Katrina is an ecosystem engineer at GitHub, the world's leading software development platform. She accidentally became a software developer whilst pursuing a degree in molecular biology. Katrina is also the creator of Exercism, a platform for code practice and programming mentorship, which has helped over 200,000 people all over the world learn new coding languages. Katrina mainly works in programming languages Go and Ruby, and she's also a Ruby Hero, which is an award given out by Ruby to their top programmers. Katrina is committed to creating beautiful code and has co-written a book about this called 99 Bottles of OOP. But Katrina, a big welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So how do you accidentally become a developer while studying molecular biology?
Well, I got my first computer when I went to university, and one of the first things I did was go to a meetup where people helped install Linux, and then I just started playing with the command line and the terminal, and eventually that led to writing little scripts. And then I think also at university I had a math, like a calculus class where we had to do some programming in Mathematica as just part of the coursework, and I got hooked, I think. So throughout the years of my study, I just did more and more programming. And towards the end of my study, I took some programming classes at university as well.
Do you remember what created the initial spark? What made you even want to go to a meetup about coding?
Well, I didn't know it was programming. And I guess technically it wasn't. It was an install fest for Linux. And I had been reading books about Linux for years. I was just fascinated by this platform that seemed to be accessible to whoever just had it on their machine, and it would enable you to make things happen. And I found that absolutely fascinating.
Picking up on the theme of accessibility, because it feels like a thread which is in quite a few of the things that you do, contributing to different open source projects and Exercism itself, which is all about accessibility and people who couldn't necessarily go to university to learn to code, learning how to do it using your platform. Where did the whole accessibility side come into play?
I think it started because growing up, I didn't have access. And I desperately wanted to know things and learn things, but nobody around me ever talked about knowing things or doing things from out of skill or competence. Everything seemed arbitrary and accidental. There was this great big belief. Everyone around me believed that things happen for a reason, that if you want something, the universe will give it to you. I mean, it was magic and fairies, and there was no structure. And I craved structure. I craved understanding how the world around me worked, but that I didn't really have access to any of that.
If you grow up believing that the universe will give you things, does that almost create a helplessness because you believe that you can't create things for yourself?
I think very much so. One of the most harmful beliefs I think I had until probably in my mid-20s was that you're born with a talent and your job is to figure out what that talent is. And so I spent my first 25 years desperately trying one thing after another. And every time something got hard, which was immediately or quite quickly, my train of thought went, well, if it were my talent, it would be easy. This is hard, therefore it's not my talent. And so I'd switch and try something else. And so I never stuck with anything long enough to actually get good at it. I didn't know that all it took was just showing up.
And all of this was to try and find your talent, like the thing that you were put here to do.
Yeah.
Did you get close when, before programming came into it, which we'll come on to later, what kind of things did you try out?
Oh my God. So I was never close. I think the biggest success that I had was, so when I was 11, my family moved to Norway and I got put into a Norwegian school with no language support whatsoever. By the end of the year, I was fairly fluent in Norwegian. And then a year later, we moved to a different place in Norway that had a completely different accent and used the other official written language. There are two in Norway. And so I kind of felt like I was starting from scratch because I didn't understand what anyone was saying. And I did very, very poorly. By this time, this was my first year of middle school in Norway. I did very, very poorly that first year in school and often went down to the bathrooms to cry because I couldn't understand what the teachers were saying. And by the end of middle school, by the end of 3 years, I had the best grades in the history of the school. And so I feel like the best, that was my biggest success, but I didn't really see it as a success. I had just worked really hard and felt like I was able at the end of schooling to do what most of the other students were able to do naturally. And it didn't occur to me that this happened because I worked really hard at it. I just thought that, oh, wow, you know, I seem to have figured this out. And then I made one of the biggest mistakes of my life. I decided to take a year off of school and spend it in Hawaii with my dad. My dad lives in Hawaii. And so I didn't have a plan for that year. And one of my dad's friends is a very good ceramics artist. And so I decided I would apprentice with this artist. And this lasted for, I want to say, a week, 2 weeks maybe, because I was bad at it and this wasn't my talent. So I quit. And then let's see, I worked for my dad. He's a fine artist. He does woodworking, among other things, but that's what he was doing back then. And so I apprenticed with him for a few months. And that was okay. I can sand and oil just fine. And then I was like, no, I'm just going to go to high school, because I was 15 at the time, I guess. And so I went to high school for a bit in Hawaii, where this was not a very good school. I didn't actually learn anything. And then at the end of the year, I went back to Norway, where my academic credentials for middle school got me into high school. And there I made the second biggest mistake of my life, which was I chose to go to a high school of performing arts and study music instead of studying something useful like science or something. I had never really done music, ever, but it was the most prestigious and hard to get into high school in the county. So since I had the best grades of my school, I was like, I can do the hardest thing. And I picked that. So I did music for 3 years and I got nowhere near brilliant at it. I was totally capable of being part of an orchestra or singing in a choir at the end of it. I could compose little baroque tunes for a multi-part choir because it's kind of mathematical and there are rules and I can follow rules. But at the end of high school, I had no idea what to do. And so I just kind of randomly moved to France and got accepted into a theater school, which I spent 2 years there. And I kind of, well, at the school, and I kind of hated it. And halfway through that, I was like, well, maybe I'll try circus. So I tried to get into one of the top circus schools in Europe, which is in France. I tried 4 years in a row, basically failed every time. And throughout all of this, I had the crappy jobs that you might have just to get by. So I was waiting tables and bartending and was a hostess on tour buses. And eventually I ended up doing a lot of secretarial work, bilingual secretarial work in French and English. Lots of typing, lots and lots of typing. I was really good at that. And eventually I was 25 years old and still had no talent and no plan, no life.
This is so fascinating. So a thread, I guess, that's gone through this is trying to find your talent and moving across various different professions and different things to focus on, almost like trying to find the thing that is your talent. What were the other frameworks that you were operating on? Like, why did you move to these specific different places and choose to do these things?
So this is really fascinating. This is how I learned to make decisions growing up. And I learned this from both of my parents, basically. The way that you make decisions in my family is that something presents itself to you. And so that thing is now an option. And you have the option of saying yes or no to that thing. And so every decision I made was, well, I could go to school, but my dad invited me to live with him for a year in Hawaii. So my decision wasn't really, what is this going to do for my future? What are the upsides or downsides? My decision was, should I go to Hawaii or should I not go to Hawaii? It's not really a choice. It's the semblance of choice. You're choosing between one thing. And that's not really choice. But I had randomly tried a mime class, a street theater class, when I was in Hawaii. And so one of the things, because I realized that I couldn't become a successful composer for film or jazz musician because I had no talent in music, one of my next thing to try was like, well, maybe this theater thing would work. And so there was I met someone who had gone to theater school in France, and so I applied to the school that they had gone to, and then I got accepted. I had this option seemed to present itself, and so I decided yes or no whether to take that option. And so every decision I made was just based on this thing appearing in front of me and trying to figure out whether or not I should go with it.
And that thing appearing in front of you ties in with the whole opportunities will come to you and the universe will present the options to you.
Yeah, very much.
So how do you make decisions differently now than how you were taught to make decisions?
So now I really try to figure out where I want to go in life. And this isn't even a destination. This is more of a lifestyle. I have this idea of what I want my life to be like. And then when something is not working, or when I realize that there are opportunities or I would like to make a change, then I try to really think through what are different options, what are the outcomes of those options. And I specifically work pretty hard to think through how am I locking myself in? Like, what are options that I've not considered? So I try to force myself to eliminate, like pretend for a moment that I can't do any of the things that I'm considering doing. What might I then do? So I do a lot more analysis. I mean, just understanding that there is a framework for decision making, that decisions have consequences, that your actions have consequences. This was huge. This fact that you can make a decision and 10 years down the road, this will have had an effect on your life. And that was the biggest epiphany that I had. When I was 25, someone was like, what do you think was the biggest mistake you made? And I thought back and I was like, wow, I probably shouldn't have just randomly gone to Hawaii and then gone to music school. And then they were like, well, what else could you have done? And I was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting question. I had never thought of it. And so I was like, well, I did really well in science and math. I could have gone to regular high school and then ended up at university doing an engineering degree or a doctorate in something, or just becoming a medical doctor or something, you know, just normal. Nobody I knew was normal. Nobody in my whole life was normal.
But then what is normal? Would you be able to define what normal is now?
Probably not, but definitely not barefoot hippies eating brown rice and granola. When I was 25 and thinking all of this through for the first time, realizing that, oh, I could have made an active choice to go for something that was more structured and definitely had opportunities. Like, if I studied medicine, I could almost certainly become any sort of medical doctor or surgeon or, I don't know, neuroscientist, something that has a job after it. And to me, that was a pretty big epiphany.
The two mistakes that you talked about then, taking a year out to go to Hawaii and going into music, when was the first time that you thought, actually, I think these were mistakes?
When I was 25, when someone asked me, what do you think is, I don't even remember the exact question, but the question had something to do with, if you could go back in time and do something different, what would you have chosen to do differently? And that's where I went back to.
So who was the person asking you these questions when you were 25?
I was taking some random personal development course.
25 seems like quite a pivotal. I think I've heard you use that number a couple of times. Is that sort of when everything changed?
Yeah, everything changed. It was so dramatic. From there, like at this point, I was a failed circus artist struggling. I had a job as a bilingual secretary for a long time. While I was working as a secretary, one of my old teachers from circus called me up and said, there's a role at the National Theater of Nice. I want you to read for it. And I was like, sure. So I took the train down. I read for it. I got the role. So suddenly I was an actor, kind of. And I went on tour with this play for a while. I mean, everything was so random. And then while all of this was going on, I realized that I could have made choices. And then I started weighing my options and realized that finally I had understood that I don't have talent. And the second thought that occurred to me once I realized that I don't have talent is like, well, I'm never going to be amazing, but I could be totally reasonably competent at something. What would I like to be reasonably competent at? What kind of job do I think I would enjoy being a solid, mediocre performer at? And the only things that I could think of were in some way scientific. So I ended up deciding that I needed to go to university, which meant that I had to learn math and physics and chemistry and stuff to get into university. And so I spent a year and a half or so learning that and taking exams. And then I got accepted to a couple different programs and chose one of them.
I really like reasonable competence versus talent as a way of thinking about what you could do, because it feels like it takes it from being very much out of your control to very much in your control.
Exactly. That was the big difference. When I was 25, suddenly I was in control.
Growing up, how would you describe your, I'm talking pre-25, how would you describe your personality back then?
Extremely introverted. I didn't play games. I didn't have toys. I read books. That was the only thing I ever did. For fun, I would learn languages, human languages. I didn't know about programming then.
Okay. What kind of books did you read?
Fantasy, science fiction, like science for lay people, biographies, anything I could come across, basically.
What got you into those books?
I think my dad read books when I was a kid.
Did you hang out with other kids much?
I had one friend.
Okay. Tell me about your one friend.
She was way more extroverted than me. And so I found her a little bit exhausting, but she was great. And so off and on, I would really enjoy hanging out with her. Her parents had a business. This was maybe the only people I knew who were successful in some way.
What did they do?
They imported things from New Zealand and sold them in Hawaii.
Okay. So when you found her exhausting, what did you do? What did you say?
Oh, I would just not go to her house for a while.
Back then, did you define it as introvert, extrovert, and realize that was why?
No, I had no idea. I remember her asking if I could come to her house, and I didn't know how to say no. So I asked my mom, and then in Norwegian said, please say no. Oh. I feel terrible about this.
It's fine. I'm sure she doesn't mind.
So let's back up for a second. I was born in Norway. When I was 2 and a half, we moved to Alaska. And when I was 7, we moved to Hawaii. And when I was 11, we moved back to Norway. And by then, I mostly didn't know any Norwegian. And then when I was 15, I moved to Hawaii for a year, went back to Norway and went to this music high school. Right after high school, I moved to France, stayed in France for about 7 years, and then moved back to Norway and did typing work to help me get through university.
So the moving around when you were much younger, what was the reason for it?
Oh, you know, an opportunity presented itself.
But how? Where did they come from?
Yeah. Okay, so my dad is American. My mom is Norwegian. My dad randomly went to Norway in the 70s to learn how to build log cabins and wooden boats. So he's a boat builder. He also does construction. And he met my mom. And previous to going to Norway and building wooden boats, he had lived in Alaska for a bunch of years and been a fisherman. So in Norway, he and my mother had the conversation that went probably something like this. Hey, let's go get rich in Alaska, and then we can move to Hawaii. And that was a great idea, so they did. But of course, as a fisherman in Alaska, we had plenty of food, but we had no money. Like all of winter, we would write things down at the grocery store that we owed them. And then when spring came and summer came and my dad went fishing, we would pay down all of our debt for the winter. So after a few years of that, they were like, let's go be poor in Hawaii instead of poor in Alaska. And that seemed like a much better idea. So they did.
And so the hippies and the rice and granola, where does that come into it?
My parents were both hippies.
Give me a definition of a hippie as you see it.
Oh, goodness. So my parents were very different types of hippies. My mom is very conscientious. I guess my dad is in some ways, but she was very much into this whole spiritual journey and brown rice and granola. All of the natural foods, the natural living, the rainbows, the crystal healing, the tarot cards, all of that, my mom was into it. She probably still is in some way. My dad was very much the free spirit, but he still lives this free spirit life where he will decide that he wants an adventure. His whole life is optimized for adventure, meeting people, discovering, having experiences that he couldn't have predicted. And so that caused a lot of moving around.
How hippie are you?
None. Zero.
And so is that a conscious choice to be different? Or when did you decide that that wasn't for you?
I mean, my whole life, it's never been for me. When I was a child, I found the sit around a fire with a guitar singing Kumbaya was absolutely abhorrent to me. I still can't stand the taste of brown rice. I don't like rainbows. I do not like rainbows. Like, crystals drive me absolutely up the wall. I find everything about the hippie spiritualism, all of it, I find it so frustrating, and I always have.
So when you were growing up, was it okay that it wasn't your thing, or was it encouraged? And was it like, come on, Katrina, get involved? Or was it like, no, she's not going to get involved because she doesn't want to, and that's fine?
Mostly I didn't tell them, but of course I would always leave if there was singing going on, and they knew this. They put up with this, but I didn't tell them explicitly that I rejected everything they stood for.
Okay. Because how would that have gone down? You would think that part of the whole being an accepting person means that you also accept that people are different and they like other things, and therefore that might be okay?
No, well, yes and. So they accept that people are different, but never square, never like what is seen as the establishment. Or an engineering job would be just, it wasn't on the table because it's not creative. It's not an acceptable path.
But then what you do now, I would say, is very, very creative.
I mean, I guess it is. I don't feel creative.
Well, I mean, you've written a book, and also the topic of the book, I wanted to dig into a little bit more, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Because our mutual friend, Jeremy Walker, who has also been interviewed for this podcast, said, ask Katrina about, firstly, ask her to give a definition of refactoring. And then ask her why it's so important and where it's come from. So for those of us who don't know, please could you define refactoring?
Yes. So refactoring is a programming term, and it specifically refers to taking code that does something useful, but perhaps isn't easy to change or easy to understand, and then systematically changing that code without changing the behavior, without breaking anything. And so it's important for a couple of reasons. One is that it lets you change things. So over time, you discover that what you're actually building is maybe a little bit different from what you thought you were building. And so you need to extend it with different features or different functionality. And the other thing is that you need to work on a team. You need to be able to communicate about the code. Other people need to come in and understand the code. You need to come in and understand the code, you know, months or years later. And by taking very, very careful, very tiny, very controlled steps over and over and over again, you can take code that is, they like to call it a ball of mud. You can take code that is incomprehensible and extremely complex and make it so that it's easy to hold in your head all at once.
This is one of the main areas of your work.
Yes.
So why the fascination with this element of everything that you could possibly look at? Why is this area so interesting to you?
I think it is because every step is very small and very controlled. And so it leads me to be in the flow of the work. I feel very much in control of this one thing. And there's an enormous sense of satisfaction when I've removed a bunch of incidental complexity, things that didn't have to be complicated but happened to be complicated because of the way they grew. And just removing that feels tremendously satisfying. I mean, I get satisfaction from putting dirty dishes into the dishwasher well as well. It's kind of the same thing. It's like, everything in its place. Everything fits.
When you were growing up, did you think, I am different to everyone around me?
I kind of grew up thinking that everyone is probably mostly like me, except they like Kumbaya and guitar singing and rainbows.
Well, I guess that's true. Like, everyone's kind of the same, and everyone has, on a basic level, the same needs.
No, I really didn't spend any time thinking about how other people are in their own heads.
I wanted to ask you about role models, because when I was asking you if you would be on the podcast, and you said, I think you said that I didn't actually have many like role models growing up.
Yeah, I didn't. I can't think of anyone who I looked up to. I mean, I was impressed with my friend's parents who had their own business. I thought that was cool, but it didn't seem like anything related to anything I could do. It wasn't in any way learnable. Again, everything being a talent, that was cool that was their talent, but how would I do such a thing? That seemed very remote. Another, like a friend of the family was a chef, a sushi chef from Okinawa. And I thought that was really cool. Again, it was like this impressive skill, but I didn't realize that that's what impressed me with it.
So in your role now and in everything that you do now, what do you get the most pleasure out of and what do you most enjoy doing?
Almost certainly, it's seeing a problem and realizing that I can fix it and almost certainly nobody else wants to, and then fixing it.
Why does it matter if no one else wants to fix it?
I'm not sure it matters, but I take an extraordinary pleasure out of fixing something that should be fixed. And the fact that nobody else is going to do it means that it falls to me. But then doing it really well, I take an enormous, tremendous amount of satisfaction from that.
That's such a nice aspect of your personality to have, like only doing something if you know that you're going to put everything into it and you're going to do it well as well.
Yeah, I don't like it when I get rushed. I was on a team where everything was always a rush and we had to change context. Like, this was a priority, but 3 days later, this is no longer a priority. But then a week later, it's a priority again. And I found that incredibly stressful. And also, everything was always under some sort of artificial deadline. And so I felt like I couldn't go do my best. And my best is always taking whatever time it takes. There was one thing, I found a problem. And this had been a growing problem over the course of, I don't know, 6 years maybe. And I decided to start hunting it down and realized that the small problem that I found was actually a big problem. And so I started pulling on that thread and searching and researching and a lot of refactoring, actually. And it took, I don't know, 10 or 11 days to get to the end of it. And it never once occurred to me to reach out to my manager and say, hey, I'm going to spend some amount of time or a week or 2 weeks fixing this problem. Because when I started, I didn't know how big it was and I didn't care. I just wanted to fix it however long it took, which I know is not very strategic. Like, maybe this wasn't strategically important. On the other hand, there's a certain class of bugs that we have never had since. So it's useful.
If you knew that you were being rushed and you knew that you weren't going to do your best work or you weren't going to feel good about doing your work because of the situation that you found yourself in, how would you get out of it?
Well, I mean, first of all, I do the work as best I can within the constraints. I do. If we have to rush, then there are things that I'll choose to not do certain things. I'll choose to cut corners and I will tell them which corners I'm cutting to make the deadline. And I'll tell them why I think it's risky to do that. And I'll put it on a list. This is my strategy for not fixing every single thing that I come across, is I make a big list of every single thing that I come across so that I can go sort this list later and say, hey, we have a whole pattern of this type of problem. Out of these 100 things that I came across, there are 40 that are all related to this one thing. How about we schedule some time to dig into this pattern of problem? And that's been successful.
I can imagine that's a very, very useful person to have on your team. Someone who knows exactly what's going to happen with everything that's cut out.
Yeah. I don't know that I know what's going to happen. I just know that there's risk inherent. And I don't tolerate risk very well. I'm not very daring.
Tell me more. Tell me more about risk tolerance.
So I took a lot of risks up until the age of 25, but not intentionally. And it was never a fun thing. All of these unfounded risks in particular have all sorts of unpleasant outcomes. And I don't enjoy that very much. I like to be able to plan. I like to take small steps. I like to carefully consider options and understand some of the potential outcomes. And nothing ever turns out the way it's planned, but just having gone through that process makes me much more able to deal with the things that come down the line.
Since the age of 25, have you changed what you would now define as a risk?
That's a really good question. Yes, I think I have. A risk now is something that I see as a trade-off. It's something where there's an upside and a downside, and you decide that the upside is worth the potential downside. Whereas before the age of 25, risk just seemed like something out of your control and scary.
That's so fascinating that when before you were 25, so like just moving to Hawaii for a year or just going and trying to join the the circus, they didn't seem like risks, but that was
in retrospect.
Yeah.
They're terrifying risks.
Yeah. But then at the time they didn't feel like them.
No, I didn't know how to manage it. I didn't know how to manage choices or risks or decisions or anything. I didn't feel like anything was under my control. Everything was fate. Everything was the universe.
If the pivotal year of age 25 hadn't happened, where would you be now? What would you be doing?
I'd probably still be waiting tables or some secretary somewhere.
Would you still be convinced that there was a talent that you were destined to do and still be looking for it?
I mean, at some point you have to give up. I think that I would have at some point realized that I don't have talent. Inevitably, I'd have to come to that conclusion.
You believe that you don't have talent. You believe that anything that you do that you're good at now, what percentage of it is natural ability and what percentage of it is because you have worked on developing that reasonable competency in it?
So I think that there are some underlying fundamental personality traits that I was born with. And those can be very useful for certain things and very disastrous for other things. So I am extremely conscientious. I know how to show up every day and do the work. I know how to now just figure out what kind of work will lead to the goal that I want. And then I'll forget about the goal and I'll just show up and do the work. I have an extraordinary amount of that. And I think that that is inherent in my personality. And I would say that that has led to being able to be successful with the type of work that I do, the refactoring, the programming, even public speaking, where I approach it very differently from a lot of people, where I approach storytelling very much as, you know, a structured, learnable craft, and I get better at it and I practice it a lot. I'm not a natural public speaker in any way. But I think that this conscientiousness is almost certainly mostly innate, and that has been a huge help towards going in the direction of being successful in the way that I have been. There are other personality traits that I think also are inherent. I don't actually enjoy, this might sound strange, but I don't really enjoy new experiences. My father is very much like, he wants to go out and have adventures. I don't want adventures. I want my day to be predictable. I really love my routine. I love all the comforts of home and my habits and the things that I do and the things that I surround myself with and the people that I surround myself with. I want all of these to be predictable. I do enjoy a good restaurant. That's kind of the only place where I'm open to experiences.
How does your routine get created? How do you decide that something is worthy of inclusion in your routine?
Oh yeah, I have a very specific process for this. I do this very systematically and in very, very small steps. So any random recent example, I had some health issues recently and discovered that I can't have cheese. Well, technically I can't have milk protein, but cheese is like a bomb of milk protein. And the other thing that I discovered is that I need to eat a lot more vegetables. And so I've been experimenting with, well, okay, what if I just prepare a roast, 2 pounds of vegetables in the morning and eat that throughout the day until it's empty and then prepare more food. That was my first experiment. It was like, okay, 2 pounds of veggies in roasting in the morning. And over time, I figure out, okay, what works with this? What doesn't work with this? Is it the timing? Is it the roasting? Is it the particular vegetables? And then I'll do very small experiments to tweak that. But I have a very structured approach to deciding that I want to try something and then making very small experiments with that one thing. And the thing I want to try is never like start exercising or be more organized or something big and fuzzy like that. It's always a very specific, small, achievable, almost underwhelming type of thing. And then I'll do little experiments to see, first of all, is this helpful? Does it take me in the direction that I want to go in? And second of all, I work specifically to remove the friction. Anything that there is in that process or that thing that has friction is going to prevent me from doing it. So I'm not looking to create a habit. I'm looking to make it so that it's easier to do it than to not do it.
Different people have different definitions of success. And I love the version of success that focuses around lifestyle, because I like that it really focuses on the now and the day to day, because really your past and present and future is just days strung together. So surely what really matters is what you do day to day, which is lifestyle and routines and habits and things that you do and things that you don't. Is lifestyle, is that how you plan everything with how it affects your day to day? Or is there something else that underpins everything that you want to do or that you choose to do?
Everything goes back to lifestyle. I could be an extremely successful programmer and have a horrible lifestyle, like a lifestyle that I hate. I could be living in San Francisco or New York, have to work 60-hour weeks for some sort of measure of success, status, I guess, money. I don't know. And I would be miserable. And so I don't go after those kinds of jobs. I don't chase after promotions at work because that's not going to take me closer to the lifestyle that I want in any way. And the lifestyle that I want is actually quite specific. I've been kind of noodling on this for, I don't know, 12 years now, maybe. And it's 100% my definition of success is being able to live day to day, having that lifestyle.
I would love it so much if careers coaching in school focused not just on what you do when you're working, but also how that facilitates what you do outside that as well. Because I don't think that if the career, like, I don't know, a solicitor or something, if that career is sold to you, I don't think anyone would ever be shown what that means that you're giving up, or what that mean, yeah, what that might mean for your health, or what it might mean for your relationships. I think that if everything was considered, then people would probably make different choices, like from 18.
I think so too. I think it's one of the key things. So it's really interesting because being a solicitor, for example, you could be, you know, a high powered solicitor in some big famous company and work almost like a cog in a big machine on this production line of doing always the same type of work over and over again. You might be paid really well, and it might or might not suit your personality. Or you could work your way up in a tiny firm that does super high profile political or criminal cases. Or maybe you could work as a lawyer for world peace and hunger and unfairness in the world, or whatever it is, working for nonprofits. Or you could choose so many different lifestyles with that one career. And I think that if you don't have any idea what types of lifestyles that career is amenable to providing, you might just end up in one of these places and not really understand why.
Yeah. Or you end up in like the default version of that career.
Mm-hmm.
Katrina, is there anyone in whose footsteps you would like to follow?
So this is something that I've thought about for a bit, because the question, the first time I heard this question, it surprised me. It didn't occur to me that that was something I could do, is even model my behavior in someone else's, or in some way use other people or other stories as a model for my own. But I thought about it a lot and realized that there is a physicist named Richard Feynman. And there are three things about him that I find very appealing and quite fascinating. The first is that he was led by his curiosity. So he's famous for having invented a whole part of physics and gotten a Nobel Prize and everything. But the thing that I find so fascinating with his work and his life is that he was endlessly curious, and he experimented. He became a really good painter, for example. He played Brazilian music. He decided that he wanted to experiment with drugs and sensory deprivation tanks at the same time. And so he did that. He picked locks. He would follow whatever strand that his curiosity would lead him to follow. And I really appreciate that. The other thing that I think is important about Richard Feynman is that he never pretended to understand something that he didn't understand. So he, when he was in university, he decided to take some biology classes because he had never done that. And he was kind of curious about what biology classes would teach him. And so he went to the class and started, you know, learning things and asking questions. And at one point he decided that he, in order to figure something out, he needed to go to the library and find the map of a cat so that he could figure something out. And so he went to the library and was basically mocked for asking for the map of a cat, because this is not what it's called. And he didn't know what it was called. And he didn't care that other people would mock him for not knowing things. He would just find them out, figure them out. If he didn't understand, he would ask more questions. He would write down everything that he did know about it to figure out what he didn't know about it, and then go look for those answers. And I just find that his approach is very much how I'd like to live my life. I'd like to be led by my curiosity. I'd like to never pretend that I know something that I don't know or don't understand. And then the third thing about him is he was incredible when it came to sharing his knowledge, explaining the things that he came to understand in ways that were inherently understandable and approachable to other people. He spent, even though he could have taught only the smartest, famousest, most, you know, accomplished physicists, he chose to give the intro level physics course or science course to students who were not studying physics or science at Caltech, which I thought was kind of wonderful.
Katrina, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can listeners find out more about you?
I've given talks. So katrinix.com/talks, probably the best thing if you wanted to know something about what I think about.
katrinix.com/talks.
Yep.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jodie.
This episode was brought to you by Clever Tykes Children's Storybooks. If you want to support the podcast and help share our ethos of inspiring, enterprising behaviour, head over to clevertykes.com and order a set of the storybooks to give to a child that you know.